Welcome to Copyright Clearances Podcast Series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. It's Friday, April 19, 2019. Our weekly guest on the show is Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer. He joins me today from Chicago, where he's attending DPLA Fest, an annual gathering of the Digital Public Library of America. Welcome back to the program, Andrew.
Hey there, Chris.
So in Paris on Monday, Andrew, Notre Dame Cathedral suffered a heartbreaking fire. In the days since, the world has rallied to support the Gothic monument's reconstruction and restoration. All the attention for Notre Dame has helped to revive the Victor Hugo classic starring Quasimodo and Esmeralda. The Hunchback story is a bestseller in France and out of stock on Amazon here in the U.S. Now, two centuries ago, the Hugo novel helped draw attention to the then sorry state of the cathedral. And today, French booksellers have called on the public domain novel's various publishers to donate a portion of their sales revenue to the cathedral's restoration fund.
Yeah, just an absolute tragedy in France. Unfortunately, I was watching it live as it was unfolding, and I actually saw the spire fall and collapse during the fire. And it's just an image that's going to stay with me for some time. And very interesting to see the effect it's had on the Victor Hugo novel and watching it climb the charts at Amazon. And if you are attempting to read that novel and can't get it from your bookstore, I should tell you that it is available for free as a public domain novel from the Digital Public Library of America or through Simply E, if you have the Simply E app that aggregates, of course, library ebooks. Yeah, public domain novel, you can just go online and get it for free from your library.
Well, indeed, Victor Hugo isn't the only public domain author in the news this week. Robert Mueller, author of the eponymous report on the investigation into Russian meddling in the 2016 election, is about to find himself on the bestseller list, too. Various publishers' editions are already hot items in pre-order on Amazon. As a federal official, Mueller won't see a dime because the report is in the public domain.
That's right. And, you know, very interesting. It was just maybe 4 or 5 weeks ago that we announced that Melville House here in New York was going to make their edition of the Mueller Report available. And they started putting it out, and it climbed up right to the top of the Amazon list. People were very, very interested in getting their hands on that. And I think that it probably will sell pretty well, even though it is freely available on a special counsel website. If you were to try to pull that thing off and print it yourself, it'd be a pretty hefty print job. So I think a lot of people actually will go ahead and just buy the report because it's simply the best and easiest way to read it.
Indeed. And the world of public domain works could change dramatically if all comes true based on an announcement at the DPLA Fest. This announcement was describing an expansion of the Simply E ebook app and offering a platform for ebook lending. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and not just public domain books. This is a very aggressive move by the Digital Public Library of America, and one that a lot of people would argue has been coming for a long time. But, you know, you're alluding to the news that at the DPLA Fest this week, the New York Public Library and platform provider Lyrisis, along with the DPLA, announced a new collaboration that aims to provide all public libraries with a free, open source, library controlled, not a third party vendor, but actually controlled by the library community, a platform for managing their ebook and audiobook lending services. And it really is an ambitious project that builds on a pilot that DPLA undertook with help from the Sloan Foundation back in 2017. That was called the DPLA Exchange. And the goal is to develop a full service pathway for libraries to acquire and to deliver ebooks and audiobooks through their own marketplace and platform. You know, as our listeners may know, I'm sure many do, that the library ebooks are largely administered through vendors, the largest of which, of course, is Overdrive. But there are many, many more. You have Biblioteca and Baker & Taylor, EBSCO, you can go on. The list is long. And our listeners will recall that NYPL and other partners first debuted the Simply E app, I think 3 years ago now. And it presented a single interface to library users, so they didn't have to go through trying to figure out which vendor was selling the ebook to the library. They could just go to one place, and the app collated them all there, and they could select their book. But now DPLA wants to take Simply E further and actually allow libraries to license the books directly from publishers through a DPLA, through, as they say, a library-controlled interface. It's a huge step.
Now, a library-controlled ebook service, can that work?
That's the question. I mean, that is a really good question, I think, and that's what we're going to find out. You know, the pilot project suggests that it can. The DPLA exchange launched in 2017. It provides access to now over 300,000 titles, including thousands of openly licensed works, public domain, etc. And it does offer a new model for this library-centered ebook marketplace and audiobooks. But the question is, can they sustain it? Funding, technology. I mean, there's a reason why Overdrive has succeeded in the space. It's because they put yeoman's work into developing their system and reaching out to the big five publishers and gotten them involved. It requires constant attention, constant technology upgrades, funding. The sense I got from librarians at DPLA this week, most notably NYPL's chief technology officer, Tony Agi, is that the vendors today have done a great job in getting us to this point. But you know, maybe at some point they've started to take up a little too much oxygen and that libraries and publishers need to deal with one another directly. And that's the ultimate goal of this project, is to give a measure of control, a better feedback loop too, I think, to libraries and publishers when it comes to the lending of ebooks.
All right. So DPLA Fest's opening plenary featured tech scholar Dana Boyd and University of North Carolina librarian Elaine Westbrooks. They spoke about the role libraries can and must play in the digital space, and they were thinking well beyond licensing bestsellers for their patrons.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing that you really only get from a library conference. It was fascinating. Absolutely great plenary session to start the entire DPLA Fest. So it's not all about licensing ebooks and content and commerce. It's really about this new digital world we find ourselves in. And both of these speakers emphasized that we are defined as much by the stories we don't tell as the stories that we do tell. And I'll give you an example for Elaine Westbrooks, who's now the librarian at the University of North Carolina. She started her job the day after Charlottesville. And she decided that she was going to go back through the UNC's collections, which she's been doing. And what she's uncovered is that there's so much history of the state that is just buried. It's largely been, to this point, a white history. The stories of African Americans and their voices have been hidden in a lot of the collections. And it's her job now to go back sure and make sure that we surface those stories and that they get a little exposure themselves. Now, Dana Boyd, who is a terrific tech scholar, I've been a fan of hers for some time, offered a really chilling speech about what she called the data void, which is the way technology is used today to sow doubt and to push narratives. You know, it's about epistemology, right? It's not that we're arguing about facts these days. We're now arguing about how we know a fact when we see it. And digital media is being used to strategically manufacture ignorance, she said. You know, it's not just about repeating a message over and over again and hoping it takes root in people's minds. It's about first creating an alternate world online and then pushing people to search online for a certain subject through the major media. And then when people do, these alternative realities pop up and they seem like they're real. And they do that through terms like caravan and incel and crisis actor. So the challenge for all of us in the digital world is not just to make these things available, but to address these data voids in which manipulators today are able to fragment knowledge and seed doubt. Now, you can read more about this session online, but suffice it to say, it was a really eye-opening, remarkable morning of talks to start the DPLA conference.
When Copyright Clearances Beyond the Book returns, Andrew Albanese considers how time and technology have shaped the arguments in an 11-year-old legal case on copyright. I'm Christopher Kinney.
I'm Mark Rotella, Senior Editor at Publishers Weekly and host of the new PW podcast, Publishers Weekly Insider. Each week, we'll talk to PW editors, authors, and other industry guests about the biggest and most exciting stories and books in the world of publishing. New episodes of PW Insider premiere every Friday. So listen at publishersweekly.com/PW Insider or wherever you get your podcasts, and be sure to subscribe to PW Insider on iTunes.
I'm Christopher Keneally for CCC's Beyond the Book. It's Friday, April 19th, 2019, and Andrew Albanese of Publishers Weekly joins me today, as he does each week, with news and analysis from the world of publishing. Andrew, you've reported this week that the reply briefs in the long-running Georgia State e-reserves case will be filed next week. You look ahead at what will be Judge Orinda Evans's third crack at crafting an opinion that can pass muster with the Court of Appeals. So give us a preview.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine, but it was April 15, 2008, the three academic publishers first filed suit alleging that administrators at Georgia State University were systematically encouraging faculty to offer students unlicensed digital copies of course readings, of course known as e-reserves, as a no-cost alternative to traditionally licensed course packs. But here we are, after two verdicts against the publishers and two reversals on appeal, the last one in October of 2018, we're still fighting this case out. But many observers that I spoke to are questioning why this case is even still going on. And more specifically, they note that we now are in this robust digital publishing and licensing world, right, where we have a growing open access movement as well. And they just wonder if the question at the heart of this case that really once consumed publishers in the digital future back in the digital past back in 2008 when it was first filed, has that fear really been mitigated by market?
Technology, especially related to publishing, has indeed changed considerably since 2008. You say some are questioning whether those changes mean the alleged threat posed by these practices has been mitigated.
Yeah, exactly. So if you look at the headlines even just recently, we see how open access appears to be picking up steam, right? With the University of California dropping Elsevier's journals packages and Cambridge University Press, one of the plaintiffs in this case, aggressively moving towards read and publish deals. Well, as Brandon Butler, who's the Director of Information Policy at the University of Virginia Library and someone who has followed the case pretty closely from the beginning told me this week, colleges and universities today are increasingly looking to university presses as partners in this open access world, which of course would include access by students and courses, he says. Also, more libraries are looking into securing ebook licenses that will allow unlimited simultaneous users. And we're, indeed, in the academic realm, we're seeing ebooks really start to grow greatly. That's a model that would make assigning a chapter here and a chapter there so much easier. I mean, librarians really don't want to be spending their time copying things for professors and worrying about whether or not they're within the bounds of copyright if there's an easy license available for them. And I think that, the ability to do that has improved tremendously. And then, of course, there's the march of open educational resources that in some cases, Butler notes, can actually replace expensive textbooks and perhaps render e-reserves less important too. So the idea of devoting resources to, you know, scanning and rescanning book excerpts, like I say, and wondering if you're doing it within the bounds of the law, you know, 11 years later after this case was first filed, it's starting to look like a practice that makes little sense going forward. In other words, the legal problems that the publishers saw 11 years ago, however real at the time, are more or less being addressed by the marketplace.
Indeed, but after 11 years, a thorny fair use case continues.
Yeah, and it's a pretty fascinating case as well, I have to say. You know, last fall, Brandon Butler offered a great take on his blog about the case, and I think he's pretty right on in his assessment, which, in a nutshell, is that this could still go either way. And here's why. In their March 22nd remand brief, the plaintiff publishers contend that the 11th Circuit has now twice instructed Judge Evans to give greater weight, determinative weight, they argue, to the fourth factor of the fair use test, which is, of course, the severe threat posed to the publisher's market by GSU's copying, and only to give moderate weight to the first factor, which is the educational purpose of the copies. In their remand brief, GS attorneys argue that the appeals court calls for a holistic fair use analysis, one that sort of doesn't take any sort of mathematical weighting of the four factors, but instead considers, and I'll quote the brief here, the collective effect and interrelatedness of all the factors against the purpose of copyright. You know, a finding against fair use in this case, GSU says, would effectively eviscerate the language of the Copyright Act, which allows for multiple copies for classroom use. But here's why it's such a hard call. Butler points out that the case just doesn't neatly fit into the two what he calls meta principles that have largely defined the last four decades of fair use litigation. That would be market failure in the 1980s and transformative use in the mid-90s. What we have is a judge facing a really compelling fair use purpose, education, right? Classroom use, and a really compelling claim of market harm by the publishers. And the appeals court, it seems, has issued only the murkiest of guidance, telling her to give the most weight to market harm, but then to just do this holistic analysis. Don't just weight up the factors and then tally them up, but to do a whole analysis that's based on the purpose of copyright. And it's just very, very confusing as to what exactly she's supposed to do. So we'll see if the third time's a charm for Judge Evans, who does have the benefit of two appeals decisions to guide her on this remand decision, but who knows whether that's enough to turn the balance in this case in her mind. In the meantime, the market does move on.
Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer, thanks for the reporting and analysis, and speak with you next week.
My pleasure, as always.
Coming next on Beyond the Book, the pastoral setting of Allowed to Grow Old, portraits of elderly animals from farm sanctuaries, comes in opposition to the harsh conditions where photographer Iza Leshko's subjects earlier had found themselves. Abe the goat, Babs the donkey, and Teresa the pig all suffered abuse and neglect before they were rescued and given the chance to live out their lives unmolested. For the photographer, getting their pictures meant getting to know them at ground level. And when she got back up, she discovered she had a book.
It was important to me that I treat these images as portraits. I wanted to show viewers of these images that these farm animals are sentient emotional beings with unique personalities. So it was important to me that I photograph them at eye level, even though it meant contorting my body in really uncomfortable positions for hours on end and lying in animal scat for hours on end as well. But I wanted to try to, with each image, show something unique about that animal. So it was less important that the image be a beautiful pig picture, for example, so much as a portrait of Teresa, a rescued pig that I had spent hours getting to know.
Photos from the farm, next on Beyond the Book. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center. Our co-producer and recording engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. Subscribe to the program wherever you go for podcasts and follow us on Twitter and Facebook. The complete Beyond the Book podcast archive is available at beyondthebook.com. I'm Christopher Keneally. Thanks for listening and join us again soon on CCC's Beyond the Book.